Enterprise Linux Security is brought to you by TuxCare, a company that helps you modernize your Linux security. Definitely check out TuxCare to see how they can help you automate Linux patching while minimizing downtime, staying compliant, and ensuring business continuity. Check them out at TuxCare.com.
Hello, and welcome back to Enterprise Linux Security, episode 107. As always, I'm here with my good friend Zhao, and we're going to talk about security. How you doing?
All good, Jay. As always, a pleasure being here. And yeah, like you said, we're going to be talking about security, about perception of security, and about like that vigilante that we once covered, about how the FBI went and started cleaning everybody's systems.
Yeah, these stories are kind of fun. I'm trying to remember what the original vigilante did. I thought it was releasing a virus that removes viruses or something like that. Wasn't that what it was?
There was a vulnerability that affected some home routers a couple of years ago, and he would go in and patch the vulnerability and close the hole. I don't know if anybody claimed credit for doing that or not, but apparently that person fixed like thousands of home routers like that.
May not have been the hero we wanted, but it was a hero we deserved. So yeah, we're going to talk about that. Perception does play into it. I guess the common question to keep in mind is how can you protect yourself from security vulnerabilities if you don't really have a good understanding of what security vulnerabilities or how they're escalating or scaling or even what's going on? Because as we're going to discuss, there's some information about this, and what people think is the case when they're asked about it isn't really going to be tying into reality. So where would you like to start first?
We can start with that. So at TuxCare, we're finishing our year in review report. It's going to be out and released for everybody to read in about a week or so. I'll be sure to ping that and add a link when we do that, probably next week, so that everybody can reach that. As I was saying, we're finishing the year in review report. We actually sent out a survey for lots of people in the industry. We got back a few hundred responses, as is usual in this type of surveys. And there are a few standout answers there that we weren't expecting and actually help explain some things that you see in the industry. The first one, as we were mentioning, is about perception. So one of the questions there was about, we asked people what they thought on how the number of vulnerabilities had changed from 2023 to 2024. If it had been higher, more or less the same, or gone down. And we got out a pretty normal distribution out of this. So about 50% of the people said that it stayed more or less the same. 25% said it was less than in 2023. And about 24-point-something% said there were more vulnerabilities than 2023. Now, again, that's a pretty normal distribution of responses. But comparing this with reality is very interesting. There were actually 25% more vulnerabilities in 2024 versus 2023. This is data from MITRE. In Linux alone, mostly due to the kernel CNA sync, which I've ranted about in previous episodes of the podcast, there is a 12-fold increase in the number of vulnerabilities, from 290 to 3,559. That's a brutal increase. If your perception of things is that it stayed the same or it's even lower than the year before, then there's a huge disconnect between the things that you're preparing for and what you believe the environment is and the reality that's actually affecting your systems. This affects many different things. First, you're not going to be planning adequately. If you're underestimating the threat level by 25%, In the Linux case specifically, if your threat environment is potentially 12 times more dangerous than what you're accounting for, then your plans are simply not going to work and have no chance of working at all. And that's a big problem. And that's why you then see stuff like people not training enough, like you're not having the right tools for the job, like you're not doing updates when you should. And that paints a really bleak image of the state of things. It's not so much keeping up with the vulnerabilities and being always informed about the vulnerabilities that came out 5 minutes ago, but there's a huge gap between that and not knowing about almost one in every four vulnerabilities that came out, not being aware that those exist. That's a really big problem.
And that's why on this podcast, we talk about this a lot. We always talk about, you know, how, what the percentage of vulnerabilities are 1 year given the previous one. And data has been a part of this podcast for the entirety of the podcast. And that's the reason you can't plan for something if you don't really know what you're planning against. I mean, you have to know what you're up against, it, or at least have a general idea. I think people that listen to this podcast generally understand that things are getting worse. So I know to an extent it's preaching to the choir, but at the same time, we need to make sure that people understand what they're up against, because planning is, you know, an extreme part of this. You got to be ready for things as much as you possibly can be. And sure, no one could be 100%, but if your information is, you know, completely wrong, then, you know, your response isn't going to measure up either. So,
and again, this affects everything. If you're a team lead and you have a team that handles cybersecurity, or if your team handles operations and you need to know maintenance on the systems, you need to prepare for a volume of work that's much larger than what you're, than what you believe it is. And that's a problem. That's going to make you miss deadlines. It's going to make you miss updates. It's going to make you be late when deploying patches. It just means that you will not be prepared. There's an expression. It's been framed differently in the military. They've framed it in slightly different wording, but it goes something like, the generals are always prepared to fight the last war, not the one that they're facing now. And that's essentially what we saw with this response. People were not aware of the actual threat level that they were facing. How do you plan your work? How do you plan for your operations? How, if you're expecting a certain number of vulnerabilities and you account for, I need X amount of hours to do that work, and now you're faced with 12 times the amount of vulnerabilities to handle. Time doesn't stretch like that, so you're going to need more time. You're going to go into overtime, you're going to affect systems, you're going to affect availability. This ties into all of that. And it just snowballs into a very large problem.
It really does, because then you have, when it comes to hiring, you're not hiring enough people to keep up with it. And the people that you've already hired are doing extra work to keep up with it. So then, you know, you think about security, which is super important. And if everyone is overly on that because there's not enough people to go around, then who's fixing the bugs and things start crashing, or then releases slip because you can't get the new version of your software out in time to meet the deadline because you're too busy fending off threat actors. I mean, the planning starts with the security, but then it domino effects into literally everything else.
Yeah. And again, that's just one of the questions that you'll see on the report. We also asked about AI integration. And again, an interesting trend there. There's a fascinating maturation in how enterprises are approaching AI. In 2023, the majority of the intent behind using AI was to drive innovation inside of the company. And everybody was saying that it wouldn't replace jobs and all of that. And now we see that 53% of the respondents say that their company is using AI to reduce costs. This is a significant shift here, and probably the facade is falling out and people are actually stating what their intent is when using AI. They're trying to reduce costs, they're trying to save money, they're essentially trying to shift jobs away. Again, working in this particular space, working in this industry, that's not a very reassuring situation that companies are actually trying to do that and looking to do that. But that ties into other problems, because AI is not perfect. You'll see errors, you'll see mistakes, and you can expect to continue to see those.
Yeah, I actually ran into this about 2 days ago, just for the heck of it. My internal automation system, I was kind of curious, okay, what would happen if the provisioner was rewritten in Rust? I'm just curious, right? So, and it's a simple bash script. It wasn't even, I mean, sure, I say simple bash script and there's over 300 lines in there, but it's simple enough in the sense that it's copying files and doing very basic things. And then I feed it into ChatGPT. I'm like, well, redo this in Rust. and it didn't compile. And then I tell it that it didn't compile. It finds a problem in its own code, and then it compiles, but has lost most of the functionality. And then the command line arguments completely don't work at all. So then I got to get on it about that. And then 10 minutes later, I had a semi-working Rust program. So, you know, it's AI is great to an extent, but, you know, you do have to kind of watch it a bit, especially considering the errors that I've encountered in this in a bash script. And I've even seen issues where I'm telling it to create a logo for the Linux Crash Course series with the words Linux Crash and Course in it, and it misspells it almost every single time. So I'm just ready to call it artificial insanity at this point.
Yeah, I'm sure. But it's also interesting to note that this trend from moving from innovation to cost optimization is exactly the same thing that happened with cloud computing. It started as an innovation tool where you would provide innovative services to your customers, and then it started being framed as a cost optimization tool. On that one, I never actually bought into the cost optimization side of it, and I still don't. I still believe it's more expensive to run stuff in the cloud than on premises, but that's just me, and I'm biased.
Well, not necessarily, because, I mean, when it comes to you being biased, because the reality, at least for me, is that cloud often is cheaper until you factor in storage. Once you, like, I've seen companies with terabytes of storage and they want to move to the cloud. I'm like, do you have any idea like what your bill is going to look like? As soon as you start putting a lot of information into the cloud, that's when it starts to scale. But I think the reason why people think that is because the barrier of entry is so low, you know, just a $5 a month virtual machine, pay for what you use, and you have like a dozen of them. It's not that big of a deal. But then start factoring in storage, and then you watch the bill skyrocket. So I agree with you. It seems to me to start off cheaper, but then it scales to be much more expensive when you start fully utilizing it.
Another thing that we looked at was the impact of some of the high-profile incidents that happened last year. The Axie stuff, the CrowdStrike incident. And it's interesting, because when the CrowdStrike incident happened, and I'm sure everybody's aware of it, but it was a faulty update that was distributed by CrowdStrike. It crashed 8.5 million systems running Windows, and it was a whole mess that happened in July.
It did a better job of crashing Windows than Windows. Sorry.
But it was actually more than that. It wasn't just the problem that it caused and the losses that it caused, which were massive. It actually made companies look at their own processes and the way that they handle software releases and updates and all of that. And we see a clear trend toward improving their processes after this happened and directly related to this. So there's a high adoption of something that wasn't included before, which is rollback plans. About 70% of respondents told us that they started to include rollback plans whenever they did the patching operations and applied updates. And they were not doing that before. So that's a massive shift. Almost all companies now started to account for the fact that sometimes things go wrong and patches need to be rolled back. And there needs to be a clear strategy to do that, not just waiting for stuff to crash.
Yeah, every good rollout I've ever been a part of has always had a rollback plan. I was actually kind of surprised later in my career when I learned that that wasn't extremely common. But at the company, one of the earlier companies I worked for, the rule was, and I agree with it, is, you know, you have a change request with a list of things that you're planning on doing, and then you have a rollback section where if you need to go back to the way things were, then these are the steps. And we would literally test on a lab environment the rollout and then the rollback. And then once we know that both work, then we could do it. But it's actually amazing to me how many companies out there just throw caution to the wind and think that they're going to have a successful implementation on the first try. working in the industry more than a few months, you learn pretty quickly that that chaos theory really does play a role here.
And like you said, change tracking and preparation is also part of my experience. I've always seen that happen. But apparently, for many companies, that wasn't standard practice, and it's interesting to see that in response, and this is the more important, the more catchy thing about this for me is that they didn't have to suffer from CrowdStrike directly to modify their processes. Usually people won't do anything until it actually affects them and touches them personally or directly. And in this case, because of the impact of CrowdStrike, they actually changed the way that they do things even when they were not directly impacted by it, which I find fascinating because it's not the experience that we've had in previous times and discussing previous incidents. People actually wait until something bad happens and then they take measures to prevent it, which is weird.
Yeah. But no, you're right. Usually people don't learn from other mistakes. I mean, it's interesting how many people hear about someone losing important data permanently, and then the thought process isn't, well, maybe I should check my backup strategy to make sure that I don't have that same problem. And then they do. And then they learn the lesson themselves. And then they, obviously no one loses all their data twice. At least I would certainly hope not. But in this case, you're right. It was like a worldwide event that was all over the news. I think we had more blue screens of death on the news during this period than we did when Windows 95 came out. I can't stop joking about that. But the reality, though, is, you know, you are right. People did notice this and they did make changes. And I'm really happy to see that.
Do you know what's interesting? The first question we had in that section was, are you aware of the CrowdStrike, or were you aware of the CrowdStrike incident, so-and-so? 13% of people said no. Let that sink in. We're talking about IT pros answering a survey, an anonymous survey, and 13% admitted to not knowing what the CrowdStrike incident was. That's, I'm going to have to use
that's
some
pretty interesting, words. Yeah.
Yeah, that's one way to put it. Okay, another thing that we focused on was open source supply chain security. We've talked about that on the show. The XE incident was the actual spark for this section of the survey, but we asked about how confident people were on their ability to track and fix problems on their supply chain. First, we started by asking if they were aware of the whole extent of their supply chain, because they'll use multiple softwares, those will have multiple dependencies. There's a whole chain of dependencies that you need to track for this. And the previous year, we had about 23, almost 24% of respondents saying that they were very confident about their ability to handle the supply chain. This year, 12%. It dropped to half. So it's a pretty substantial drop in confidence here. And our analysis here is that obviously people are becoming more aware of how difficult it is to do this. So they lose some of that confidence that they might have.
Yeah. And sometimes losing confidence can be a good thing because it's a reality check. You realize that, you know, you could be doing something or maybe it's not as good as you thought. And, you know, that goes right back to planning, like we were talking at the beginning.
But still, a drop in 50% in confidence is pretty massive. And then we asked about what measures they were taking and how they handled security incidents in part of the supply chain and all of that. And there is one aspect of one of the graphs that we get, one of the responses, obviously. From the people who told us that they don't have a formal plan to handle cybersecurity incidents in the supply chain, and I find this remarkable, 7% of the people with no plan tell us that they're very confident in their ability to handle cybersecurity incidents. This is where the title for this episode comes from. They have no plan. The plan is to have no plan at all, but they're very confident that the plan is going to work, which, again, mind-blowing.
That reminds me of when I, this was so long ago, I don't even remember what year this was, even like way before the YouTube channel was even recognized by more than a few people, I had an interview at Facebook for a job, and their mindset at the time was break fast, fix faster. Literally. So it kind of reminded me of that. Oh, we have no plan. It's just if it breaks, fix it faster. Okay, I guess.
I mean, okay, not having a plan, I know it's difficult to handle supply chain, so you're admitting you have no plan, but you're very confident in that approach. I mean, you really have to not be paying any attention at all to be confident in that, but again.
We have to keep in mind the Cylons had a plan.
This reminds me of the Dunning-Kruger effect, where those with the least knowledge or preparation have the highest confidence. And it really fits this like a glove. You have no plan, you have nothing to do, you have no way of fixing a problem when it happens, but you're absolutely confident that you're going to fix it.
Again, do you think people get like a false sense of confidence when you have a system administrator who, let's just say, they're generally pretty good at figuring things out? And they generally fix things pretty fast, and that's just the way it's been. And then they get this false sense of security that they're always going to be that fast and they're always going to be that prepared just because it just so happened to work out well for them up until that point. Sometimes knowledge can create overconfidence because, you know, we got to understand. I mean, we have a very specialized industry here with it's not like any other industry. So I think a false sense of confidence is a little too easy to get sometimes.
You're talking from the sysadmin perspective or from the person who has the sysadmin working for him?
Well, I'm talking about from the sysadmin perspective. You know, if someone is, you know, used to, you know, fixing things in the nick of time and they always do, well, you always do until you don't, unfortunately.
Exactly.
Right.
And like you said, it only works until it doesn't. And the moment that it doesn't, man, that's an eye-opener. Don't worry, everybody goes through that in their career. It happens to everybody. There will be a problem that stumps you like it does everybody else. And you'll spend an inordinate amount of time trying to fix it, and it ends up being something silly. But
yeah,
when that happens, when you're not able to fix that problem like you fixed all the others up to that time, two things happen. First, you lose a bit of that overconfidence, like you said. And it's always good to be brought down a few pegs if you're up there. Mm-hmm. But you also start to give the correct value to planning and to actually having a plan to get in and out of certain situations. And handling stuff like cybersecurity incidents is the type of thing that requires proper planning. I mean, you can fix it and you can try and go ahead with just that attitude for a few days, but it will never work in the long run. You need proper planning. You need proper processes in place to handle things, or you will eventually fall into this trap and you will eventually be stumped with something that you're just stuck and have no way out.
I'll put it like this, okay? To really put this into perspective, I've created probably, and I'm guesstimating, over 1,200 videos. I've had the YouTube channel since 2012. I've been working in the industry 20 years. I've written 6 books about the industry. I'm still stumped regularly. Okay. Just put that in perspective. Like it's funny because Zhao and I will sometimes have a conversation before we even hit the record button where we talk about Jay's weird issue of the week. Like I asked Zhao, like, have you ever seen this problem before? And usually the look on Zhao's face is like, what the heck? And then eventually I figure it out, you know, and maybe not like right away. Sometimes it might take me a week or a couple of weeks, but depending on the severity of the problem, I always figure it out. But it's not the case that, you know, I could just snap my fingers and I know everything about everything immediately. It takes, you know, I have to look at logs just like anybody else. I have to do, you know, a complete look at everything and find out, you know, what's related to it, what's within scope of the problem, to isolate the problem space, to find the root cause of the problem. You know, there's this process that I go through. And sometimes, yeah, I find out the problem in 5 minutes. It's a typo in my Ansible. Okay, I've missed a colon or something. That's pretty easy. But then, you know, like last night, I go to log into my Proxmox server and I can't. I can log into one of them in the cluster, but one of them I can't for no apparent reason. So, now I got to figure that out. And I think the realization of the fact that we're human and we're not machines is very important here because every time you encounter a problem, you fix it, you make a mental note, preferably document the note somewhere. But then eventually a time comes where something isn't obvious. And it always is obvious once you figure out what it is that caused it. But at the very beginning, you're like, what in the heck is this? And why did this work yesterday? And now everything is just falling over. And that's just life as a sysadmin.
Another thing that we found was that, again, we all know that it's challenging, but managing dependencies, we see that 56% of the people who responded said that they were struggling with keeping up with all the dependencies and making sure that they were up to date. And again, we know that software is getting increasingly more complex. in the middle of last year, for example, there was some stats in the Maven repository. This is a Java repository for dependencies and all of that. The average project there used about 140 dependencies, and that's the average project. There were projects that use many, many more than that. It's tough to keep up with that. It's tough to have a solution and be able to know when a vulnerability appears in one of those dependencies and have the ability to find the replacement and an updated version and all of that. It's not that easy for everybody. But it's interesting that companies are shifting away from full automation. This is where we go back to the beginning. In 2023, for the same question, we had about 15% of people telling us that they were using full automation and fully automated tools to find the updates for the dependencies. Now it's only 2.5%. So people are moving away from full automation.
That makes sense to me, yeah.
The really interesting thing about this pattern of answers here is that it seems to all go back to the CrowdStrike incident. It influenced patch management decisions in that people no longer trust the fully automated stuff, the ones that did before. They no longer rely on just getting all the updates all the time. There's still manual intervention, and we see in the answers that people are opting for systems where manual intervention is always necessary, but also for the way that the patches are tested and the way that there are systems to receive the patches before the others, and you have some tiering of systems here. And it's really interesting because it all seems to tie back to the CrowdStrike incident. This was massive. It affected the industry deeply. It affected many systems directly, but it also impacted the way that the processes happen inside of organizations.
Now, about the automation thing in it showing a decline, I don't have any data right in front of me to back up what I'm about to say, but I'm just going to talk about something that I've experienced because I've worked with lots of MSPs. And a lot of the MSPs I worked with had, you know, a bunch of clients, and we work on projects for the clients because that's why they pay us. And automation, getting automation implemented was, at least right before I went out on my own, the number one thing that I think nearly the majority, at least with the MSPs I was working with, were trying to get involved with. They were basically like, okay, we automate nothing. We want to automate. We want Ansible or whatever it is. And we want to get this implemented. And what usually happens in my experience is they don't understand the full scope of what they're getting into. Okay. They just think they talk like, yeah, I'm going to automate everything. Just like somebody might say, I'm going to get a sandwich at McDonald's tomorrow. I mean, it's like such a nonchalant conversation, and they don't fully analyze the scope. They don't fully, know everything that the automation system is going to do. They don't necessarily know how to react. So for example, when I automate, and I do automate everything, by the way, some of the challenges I run into is the version of Ansible on one distribution versus another. I use Ansible pull, which, you know, I feel is the best way to use Ansible. But the downside is, Debian has version X of Ansible, CentOS has version Y, and then Fedora has version whatever. And then you run into situations where there's a module in Ansible as of a certain version that's not in the previous one. So then you have to have like some kind of a, logic that says, okay, if you're running on Debian, you need to do this. If you're running on Fedora, you need to do this. And you run into things like this extremely regularly, and you have to know how to deal with these things. And when someone is trying to implement automation in a company, it's way too easy to at some point just say, we've been working on this for a couple of years and it's just not where we want it to be. And we're putting all this time into it. Why are we doing this when it never really seems to get to the finish line? Because it goes back to planning, proper assessment of the systems, documentation of what it is that you need automated in the first place, SLA, SOW scope, all of that factors in. And then when you don't, research this properly at the very beginning in the project management phase, it's just so easy just to throw up your hands and say, you know what, we have better things to do. It's a really hard thing for a company to adapt. It's super easy if you're a startup and, from the day you open business, you automate everything as you do it. That's like extremely rare, and almost nobody gets that ability because almost everybody works for a company that's already been in existence for a while, and they're trying to take business processes that have existed for like 10 years, and then all of a sudden now I want to get all of these automated. It's a huge undertaking. It really is.
Sorry, I got hung up when you were saying about the modules that weren't present on one distribution and were present on another. It's like In Linux, we have to build dependency inheritance on every single thing that we use.
Oh my God, yes.
Package managers, modules for Ansible, PHP modules, Apache, it's everywhere.
And when you get to universal packaging, I won't stay on this too long, I promise. There's a lot of opposition in the Linux community where, you know, like you see Ubuntu, for example, on Facebook talking about Snap technologies. And then you have people in the comments saying, apt remove Snap, like as if like they're just being oppositional about universal packages. But what I don't think people really fully understand how bad Linux packaging is. Because I remember when I first started, it was probably just a little bit after I started, but when Ubuntu first came out, I'm like, oh, this is pretty cool. I like this. And then around the same time, a new version of OpenOffice came out. And I was like, oh, cool. It's a new version of OpenOffice. I want to run this. And then I go to a forum. I'm like, well, how do I get this installed? And like, you don't. You wait till the next version of your entire operating system. I'm like, you have to be kidding me. How does anybody think that's okay? Because a macOS user or a Windows user, when they hear new version of LibreOffice, they go and download it. They run the setup file. It's on their computer. They don't care. But Linux distributions, we've normalized that the entire software stack cannot update until the next full release of the operating system. And we've normalized this. And I've never understood that. And then you get people that are compiling code, right? They want to run a new version of Nginx because it has a feature set that isn't in their distribution. So then they compile it and it works great and everything is fine. And then they leave the company and then another administrator comes in and takes over the job and does apt install Nginx and then gets all kinds of errors. It won't run. And then they find out that the previous person compiled it manually and then they have to go back and figure that out. And then people still want to be oppositional about universal packaging. I'm sorry, my opinion is always going to be the distribution packages, your dev packages and your RPM packages should be kernel, driver only. Anything user level needs to be a universal application to be completely outside of that. But again, like you said, we just focus on dependency hell and we think that's okay.
That was an oddly specific example that you used there about Nginx.
Yeah, you caught that, didn't you? Yeah. I ran into that. And there's a number of other compiled applications that also caused problems at that company. But Nginx was one of the ones we were running the most because we had a lot of web servers going. So that was a lot of fun. I think at one point they even had a support agreement with Nginx to custom compile some features into it that they were paying lots and lots and lots and lots of money for just to then have to compile it anyway. It was great.
I was actually laughing here because I was actually in the same situation a few years back where I had to manually compile Nginx to support video streaming because the version that shipped with the distribution I was using didn't support it and had no version that did. Again, same situation. I also faced problems when upgrading the system. Regardless, we've talked about the survey a lot. Again, there are lots of interesting questions there, not just the ones that I mentioned here. There's this interesting data there, which is always useful when you're trying to validate your decisions. And we can move on to the other story of today, which is about the FBI deleting malware from computers infected by it. As we were mentioning at the start, we covered a story a few years ago where we had this person or individual or group of persons who went around and fixed and patched home routers that were exposed to some vulnerability. And that person would just go into the routers, patch the vulnerability, and then leave, and nobody knew who it was. I don't know if anybody claimed credit for that or not. But the FBI apparently was in a situation recently where they did just that. So, again, yeah. Bear with us. We're not making these names up. These are the names that are being used. So this group, apparently China-affiliated, called Mustang Panda, a.k.a. Twill Typhoon. Again, impossible to make this
up. What else do they call it?
Yeah. Ridiculous. So these guys, they developed a version of a malware strain that's been around for a few years now, and they created a variant of it, and they used it to infect thousands of systems, and apparently 45,000 IP addresses in the United States contacted the command and control server. And the FBI, working with French law enforcement, got access to that command and control system, and they simply issued the delete command to the installations that they found. And that resulted in 4,200 systems being cleaned of the malware, which is, again, impressive, but not the 45,000. Still, the same type of operation. Someone just goes into the systems and cleans them up, and no one tells the operators anything. There was this indication in the affidavit that was provided to in the Federal District of Pennsylvania that they would contact the owners of the systems. But again, given that you only have IPs, it's very difficult to actually find the people who own the systems to get in touch with them and tell them, hey, I've cleaned your system. So, again, I don't know how you handle this in the US, but I would find that to be very difficult to do elsewhere. So,
well, I'm not a lawyer, but I think that would be what's called a subpoena chain. I think there'd be subpoenas filed to get the information unsealed from the ISP just so they'd have it to contact them to begin with. But again, that's, you know, I'll say that with a grain of salt because I might be wrong on that. But I think one thing that is for sure is that it's not easy. And we talked a little bit of, you know, before we started about, okay, if there's 45,000 IPs that had this malware and then cleaned 4,200 of them, you know, why that and not the 45,000? But we really don't know the state of the machines. For example, if you think of a standard laptop that has malware on it, and then someone just puts it on suspend and then puts it in their bag, I mean, there's no network connectivity at that point. So it's not going to have access to anything. So if the FBI is sending out something that's going to delete malware, if your computer's not awake or even turned on or plugged in at that time, and who knows what kind of firewalls or, you know, things that could have been in the way. But 4,200 is still a pretty good, pretty big number of machines. And it's also interesting to me that the malware had a delete function at all. I mean, that's also pretty noteworthy.
Yeah, it really is. Usually whoever creates this type of malware, they don't really bother with a way to erase them, because what they want is maximum spread. They want to hit as many systems as possible. They want to infect many systems and remain undetectable. They're not really worried about removing themselves from the systems because they want to be there for as long as possible. And so why build a self-delete function? So this actually gives some credence to the claim that this is state-sponsored, in that having that feature built in lets you use malware for other operations than just infecting and stealing some data from them. You can actually move your operations into espionage and corporate secrets and all of that because you have the ability to erase your traces. You will leave nothing behind. Not all malware has that ability because, again, it's not useful for most scenarios. So this does lead some credence to the claim that it's state-sponsored in this situation, which we usually find it hard to believe, but there might be something there on this particular situation. Another interesting thing here is that the malware spreads through USB devices. So it infected 45,000 machines through you infected USB devices. So you have device, it doesn't spread through the network. You insert the USB device there, it copies itself to the device, then you plug it in somewhere else, it infects the next machine. And yeah, 45,000 systems infected this way, that's pretty massive.
Maybe the hacker group should have called themselves SneakerNet Typhoon.
that's a pretty massive operation right there.
Right. It really is. And this is one of the many reasons why we tell people don't insert a USB device that you don't know its origin. I mean, if any one of these devices were, you know, someone plugged in a flash drive and then the malware copied itself to that flash drive and they put the flash drive in their pocket and then they drop it in the parking lot or something when they're walking to their car, someone picks it up and then, you know, now the next thing you know, they have that same malware. And It's funny how few people take this seriously. They think, oh, free USB device. I could use another flash drive. That's pretty cool. I can never have too many flash drives. I'll just pick up this random flash drive I found and put it in my computer. What's the worst that could happen?
So many things. But yeah, another thing, and we were also mentioning this before we started recording. I would be very surprised, and really, really surprised, if the FBI and the French law enforcement had only cleaned the systems that are in the US. They only mentioned numbers for the US-based systems here, both for the infections and for the ones that are cleaned. But since it required the collaboration of French authorities as well, I'm sure there are systems infected elsewhere in the world, and it would be really a nice job that they do if they clean those systems as well. So not just the US-based ones. Again, the FBI focus, I assume it's just the US, but it would just be the nice guy thing to do here.
It really would. And I think it's, I mean, there's a level of humor here, obviously, where, you know, you have threat actors putting in a delete function. The FBI finds it and they're like, you know what, why don't we just use their own delete function to delete their malware and then send out some commands or whatever it is they did to execute that or to get that to trigger on the remote machines. And then, you know, we most likely have a bunch of people who are infected that will literally never know that they were infected. They will never know there's anything there. Maybe they were using their computer one day and they're like, man, it's kind of slow today. Maybe I should have IT look at this. And then 5 hours later, it's fast again. I guess it's fine. And then they don't think anything more of it. That's the average computer user, you know, it's just going to think it's a fluke and they're not even going to raise an alarm.
So what isn't a fluke is that we have gone through another episode of the podcast.
Yep.
As always, thank you very much to everybody who joined. It was a pleasure. And until the next one, thank you, everybody.
See you next time.
Until the next one.